chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Christ make dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is a rebroadcast that we had, that Charlotte and I had a number of years ago. With David McRaney. He's the author of You Are Not So Smart. We really got into some very, very deep subjects about mind control and marketing and branding and all these other things. This actually was really in concert with and parallel to my own studies that I've been conducting of the last 30 years in what I call delusion. But he did write an excellent book here, so I want your listening audience tonight to pay close attention. It is a rebroadcast with David McRaney, and You Are Not So Smart is the book. What's breaking in the current news out there is that there's a big scandal. Of course, I guess everyone has heard what's going on with Donald Trump. He's being plagued by his mouth again. This goes way back, 10 years back, you know. But they're beginning to pick, they found a chink in his armor, see. And so today, if you look at all the different media out there, especially the media broadcasters, the CNN, I was watching some panel discussions. They're out there in St. Louis now preparing for tomorrow's second debate, presidential debate. So it's really conjuring up a lot of questions now about how Donald Trump will handle this scandal. It goes back to some words, some very lewd words that he was talking about women and hustling them and things like that back in 2006. He has apologized recently for this, but many of your left, people on the left, your yellow dog Democrats are just hammering away. That's not enough. You know, it's disgrace to women and all this other stuff. But they're totally ignoring Bill Clinton's all kinds of transgressions against women. And also, Hillary helped cover up many of those transgressions. So they're focused right now on the news because the news is controlled by the big money. Right now, the big money does not want Donald Trump in there. And I'll tell you the reason why. He's somewhat of a loose cannon. He has these billions of dollars. He's spending maybe between $60 to $100 million of his own money in the race so far. He has ignited and touched a nerve out there, a populist nerve. So he's quite a populist, you know. There's been some people over the years, you know what I mean, that become populist and they just catch on, you know, like forest fire, like a prairie fire, you know, running across the prairie unrestricted, you know. And that's how Donald Trump's popularity has exploded. But what initially caught the attention of the American public with was immigration issues. The American public at large is sick and tired of this unrestricted, uncontrolled immigration that's overwhelming our country, see. And so the public at large is, they don't know all the ins and outs about the New World Order and all that, but they know enough to understand that these unrestricted, unvetted people coming into this country, and especially the Muslim types that are very, very strong Islam believers, and the more radical jihadists, you could say, present a real problem. The way that this thing was set up was with 9/11, see. before 9/11, we didn't have all of these jihadists and all these terrorists running around. We didn't have all of this domestic disturbances and shootings like we have in the last few years, see. But 9/11, Project for a New American Century, in some of their writings, wrote that we need another Pearl Harbor to galvanize, to begin to organize the American public around a much more authoritarian, statist type of management, organized government, you could say. And so 9/11 comes on, and many people maintain today that it was an inside job. I believe that we need, I can't positively tell you all the facts out there that I strongly suspect that we need another deeper investigation. And I believe that Donald Trump would agree to that, and he might even do that. And I believe the fear of the system, or you could say the system, the establishment, the insiders, the globalists, the international financiers, you could put all these people together, because that's who they are in opposition to him, because they fear that he might open up the 9/11 and might start a new investigation into 9/11. If Donald Trump or someone else that was very, very patriotic and believed in this country ever got into the top office as President of the United States and opened up a reinvestigation and looked into 9/11, then the network and the power blocks that exist because of the networking through the Federal Reserve, the financiers, globalists, traders, manufacturers, and the people that dominate, you could say that top 1% or even the top several tenths of a percent. If Donald Trump or someone else that really cared about the country was able to achieve that top office and started an investigation into 9/11, then their little party could be over with. This is what they fear more than anything else, because it is the basis for their continued, say, war on terrorism. And the problem with this is that if 9/11 was an inside job, this terrorism, some of it is real. We've got, real jihadists, real fanatics out there. We believe that in my discussions with Todd Fletcher years ago, he and I both agreed that some of this terrorism that's being affected inside of our country are false flags and government black ops operated and controlled and initiated. But then there are other real terrorists that have been coming into this country because of the non-vetting and the unrestricted immigration that would be, in my mind, and I don't know, Todd has passed away now, bless his soul. But anyway, I believe that some of this terrorism is real. Some of it is fabricated by deep black operations run by our government. So, and the same was true. And if you go back and you look at the Gladio operations in Europe, these were secret operations run by the intelligence operations operatives over there in Europe. And they were to tension the European government, see. And in tensioning those European governments, then they could manage those populations more easily with the fear of this and the fear of communist takeovers. And many of those, especially in Italy, were like the Red Brigade was the target of the, they were targeted as being the cause of the terrorists and the bombings over in Italy, see. So you have a large system of control. And we're beginning to see it unfold in this country, and it's becoming dangerous to our freedoms and liberties. This is the problem with it, is that we can argue 9/11, but we can't undo all of the trauma-based programming, I believe, that has been induced into the American public at large. See, when you have a tragic event like this, it reaches deep into our psyche. And with the ability to replay this over and over again with recorded videos, then you're re-indoctrinating, you're reprogramming, you're re-hurting. See what I mean? You're re-harming that psyche. And the way it works is that people are get mad as hell about 9/11, and they're ready to go to war about it, and that's why they got them to support these foreign wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. See, if you'll notice, these politicians, all they would have to do is to grab hold of some support and some response from an audience. All they'd have to do is bring up this, they attacked our country in New York at 9/11 at the World Trade. They would start talking that rhetoric, and boy, that audience would come up, because that hate that was in, responded, that was a response to that attack, is what they're using and manipulating the public through. So it's not easy to talk about these matters, see. Now Trump, he's put his foot in his mouth since he began his campaign. There have been people close around him, close to him, that I'm sure that have brought this up. But when you have a man that's worth that much, that many billions, see, he doesn't listen to anybody hardly. Many of the Giuliani and them, the top advisors, entered into the Trump Tower today. There was video on CNN earlier showing many of the people that are his top advisors have met earlier at the Trump Tower. And so we don't know exactly what's going to come of that yet. But the difference between what he did and the difference between the transgressions, the violations of women by Bill Clinton are extremely different. See, talk is not action. Bill Clinton acted against many women inappropriately, and several women alleged that he raped them. And that is far in excess of anything that Trump has done or alleged to have done through this dirty talk video that was released. But the public is being manipulated on this. They're using all kinds of rhetoric and psychological warfare here against Trump to knock him down. All of his enemies residing in the Republican Party have already stepped up and are denigrating him as a terrible person and so forth and so forth and so on. So this chink in the armor, they found one, and he's been very, very critical of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. So this little chink in the armor is being opened up to maximize the maximum, you could say, attack mode, or the inflicting the most harm to his campaign. I think Pence has already said something too that it's not complimentary to what was said in that video. So anyway, when you have Trump and you're trying to deal with a person like that, he has a big ego. He's hard to deal with. He's hard to tell anything to. He thinks he has all of the answers, and so he doesn't listen enough, see. And so I know on the last debate, all Hillary had to do was start attacking his dad and bring that up. And then, but Trump was under a lot of pressure. His mic was not working. It appeared that Hillary had an earpiece. I believe that's been proven. She also had help on her podium there. It looked like there could possibly have been a tablet or some kind of a iPad or something approximating that. We have reports that they received information about the questions earlier in the week. Her campaign did. It goes on and on. This is one of the most vicious, dirtiest campaigns that I've ever had privy to observe. So we're it's not going to get any nicer. This is Sunday night, tomorrow evening. We're Saturday on the 8th here of October, and tomorrow night from St. Louis will be the second debate. I can't even imagine what could occur there, because you know, Trump gives his story about the snake, and this woman took the snake in. The snake ends up biting the woman and killing her. And then she asks the snake, "Why did you do that? I helped you and brought you in from the coal." And then the snake replies, Well, you knew I was a snake when you took me in. When he first started on this last debate with Hillary, she started using, from the beginning, every psychological under the belt, below the belt, and psychological, emotional criticism and destructive mode that she could jump into. She can't be trusted. She has a history of going in just in the last decade here into Libya and then fomenting also the war in Syria. These are very destructive things. We see that those are just almost direct orders from the Bilderberg group. And then we've got this all this streaming of Muslims into Europe. It's transforming the culture. They're destroying the culture. Now, this country, the same thing is happening here in America, is that with the streaming in of these other different ethnic groups from different countries, including the Muslim faith group, then America is being transformed into something that is entirely different than we've ever really desired to have. We don't have an American anymore. We have all of these African American. We have a Hispanic American. They give all of these different names to being an American. So if you look very carefully, okay, at some of the institutions that have affected some of this change, you could say the Aspen Institute was early on in fomenting and formulating multiculturalism. They also helped put together their public broadcast, okay, networks. They started out as educational networks, and then they evolved those into a public broadcast. If you'll look back, you'll see that the Aspen Institute of Humanistic Studies, by the way, has been formatting a program, you could say, of scientific, religious, and secular humanism through those kinds of public outlets. And also, social and moral relativism runs rampant in there, and it's a transformation tool to transform America into something other than Americanism, see. They want to do away with the top elites in the world. America presents a barrier to their efforts to consolidate and to establish a new world order and a world government. So when you take the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution along with our Bill of Rights, it presents a problem for the new world order and the world elites. And so they're out to destroy those concepts of Americanism. That's what Americanism is. We should encourage people that want to immigrate to this country legally to take on the American ideals and principles and learn those and begin to espouse those. Because out of those came the freedoms, individual freedoms that we all share. Yes, there were slights against the blacks because of slavery and so forth, and those have been remedied to a certain degree. So there have been problems in any system of rule of government. But America, as it's presented now, or in the last few decades, it's changed a lot in the last few decades, but the principles and ideals upon which Americans used to count on to protect their individual freedoms and rights have slowly been assaulted and attacked through the changing of the concept of a living, breathing constitution, which means that it can die then. And so all of these Harvard's places, that they've been detrimental, really, to Americanism and what it really stands for. And they have not been helpful at all. I want to thank you for listening this evening. And anyway, this first hour, I hope you'll enjoy it. And then we do have a second hour with the same author, David McCaney. So I hope you get a lot out of this. We're talking about delusion, and we're talking about trying to bring people out of that deluded state into a state of enlightenment is the way I would describe it. And David McCaney, he has his own view of it and describes it a little bit different. But we all have our own view because we've had our own, you could say, path individual paths, very unique paths, each and every one of us.
And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Charlotte, how you doing? How's the weather up there? Okay? Doing okay?
Yeah, it's getting a little fall-like.
Okay, it's about 77 degrees here in Austin, Texas, and Minneapolis is a little bit cooler up there at our control in Minneapolis area. We have a very fine guest this evening. I'll bring him on in just a second. I want to tell you a little bit about him, and he can expand that a little bit. He loves psychology and technology and the Internet. He fused all this together, and he worked his way through college, waiting tables, working construction, selling leather coats and so forth. And then also after college, he went and worked as a journalist. He cut his teeth covering Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast in the Pine Belt for several papers. And we want to welcome to our program David McRaney.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
Hey, you wrote a book, too, isn't that the case? You wrote the book, You Are Not So Smart?
Yeah, David, tell us how you got started on that. Did you have a blog first, or tell us what had it happen? Tell us exactly what went on in your mind to make this thing go.
Okay.
From journalist to author.
Right. You Are Not So Smart is a blog I started about 3 years ago, and it came out of the fact that when I was in college, the first 2 years in college, I spent thinking I was going to end up being a psychologist when I graduated, but I ended up gravitating more toward writing, more toward the working for the student newspaper, and I got deeply involved in all that. And so by the time I left college, I sort of went on a journalism path and did that beat reporting stuff, but I always had that love of psychology. I was always that guy that tells you at the party that, oh, no, that's not actually how it works. It works more like this. It's a little thing called priming. And so by constantly annoying my friends with it being the guy who was always trying to pull out that stuff, I felt like it would be really fun if I could go back and find the things in psychology that gave me the greatest epiphanies, the parts about self-delusion and self-delusional thinking. And if I just made a blog that focused on that, it might be a really fun thing to do. So I went back to writing full-time, I went back to writing part-time on the blog and doing that along with my full-time job. And somewhere in, after a few months into it, I had gotten into a argument with a couple friends about brand loyalty, and I sort of researched why it is that we have brand loyalty, what goes into becoming brand loyal, and that single blog post became very, very popular, and it sort of launched the popularity of the blog and gave me the opportunity to write deeper and more in-depth pieces.
Right. What is it about brand loyalty, while we're on the subject there, that causes people to be what, ultra loyal to certain brands, right?
Yeah. Well, brand loyalty is an old thing that I like to say that it in just about everything that psychology studies and quantifies is something that marketers and advertisers have known about for a long time. It's just sort of through trial and error they figured out what works and what doesn't work. And brand loyalty is something that comes out of when we purchase something that's not necessarily necessary. Like if we purchase something other than, say, toothpaste or toilet paper or whatever, it's something that's expensive and it says something about our taste, it says something about our philosophy toward life. When we go on to a brand in that way, we will end up defending it as if it was a part of ourselves, if it becomes part of our self-image. And we also want to stay consistent. We have a deep desire to keep our self-image, keep our self-esteem high. And a lot of what goes into keeping your self-esteem high is to look back on your past choices as being proper and right and true and level-headed. And there are dozens of other biases that come into it, but they form this kind of super cluster of behaviors that end in what I call, in what is called brand loyalty. And you can see it every day on the internet with people arguing over which is better, Mac or PC or Android or iOS or Ford, Chevy. And it goes into your political thinking too, whether it is Republican, Democrat, Libertarian. And it's really a fascinating path that we go down to become brand loyal.
Right. Is it a product of ego then, what you were saying there in your blog and your book?
Well, I mean, the overall message of the blog and the book is that you are unaware of how unaware you are. But it doesn't feel that way. You don't feel like you're unaware. We have a deep desire to keep our self-esteem high and to be feed that self-esteem model by looking back on all of our life and sort of creating a narrative. We explain our thoughts, emotions, and our actions as though we were explaining those of another person. But we're not just any other person, the person that we are the biggest fan of in the world. And even though the sources of a lot of our behaviors, the sources of a lot of our thoughts and emotions are impossible to actually determine, we don't see our lives that way. We look back and we explain ourselves through a story that paints us in the best image possible.
I can tell you an anecdotal story that will exemplify what you guys are discussing, and that is when I left home, served a brief 5 years in the United States Navy, then I got married, and as soon as I got married, I started buying the same brands that my mother bought. And I didn't actually like them. And I thought, why? One day I stopped and looked around and said, why am I doing this? And I realized it was a, Ivory soap, Tide, one by one, I detached myself from these comfort items. For me, it was a comfort thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of, I'm an adult now and this is what I do. And I obviously got away from that, but it's so true. We do wrap up, there's a lot wrapped up in the soap decision I make. And I know that sounds weird, but it's true.
Well, you see, we're not hunter gatherers anymore, and we're not struggling day by day to, keep ourselves from, starving and dying. We were pretty well off, even those of us who aren't that as well off as others. And when you are into that materialist society where we all pretty much have the same access to the same stuff, and if you go through any random person's house, they own pretty much the same stuff that you own. People begin to identify who they are and compete with each other for status or with taste. And people try to become a better consumer than the other person by having the most authentic or the best researched item. And it becomes a trail you try to keep up, and you kind of try to keep saying to your peers that I've bought the best thing out there, and brands understand exactly how to play into that, and brands understand how to create a philosophy that you become a part of, and you become more of a person who buys into the philosophy than into the actual product itself.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Well, I was going to say, I was a rhino, Republican in name only, and I didn't know it. I wrote a series of papers on the Waco catastrophe. I consider it a catastrophe. And my writing teacher would say, I wrote every single paper, argumentative, comparison, da-da-da-da-da, it was a basic college-level class for writing, but I managed to write on the topic of Waco. And she said, why are you a Republican? I said, because my dad was one. Without, a thought. But I was a rhino.
Yeah, David, we got to take a break here in about 10 seconds, but we'll be right back, and we'll talk about being predisposed or preconceived notions and patterns. You've got quite a saying here. I'll read it right when we open for the next segment. But thank you for being with us, David. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to author David McRaney, who wrote the book "You Are Not So Smart."
Okay.
A celebration of self-delusion.
Okay, here's a quote that I promised our listening audience, and I would like for you to respond here and expand on it a little bit, David. Here it goes: from the greatest scientist to the most humble artisan, every brain within every body is infested with preconceived notions and patterns of thought that lead it astray without the brain knowing it. So you're in good company. No matter who your idols and mentors are, they too are prone to spurious speculation. What would you have to say about that? Expand on that, David.
Well, what I'm trying to, one of the other overarching themes of the book is that we are all in this together, and we're all very flawed, and there's a really beautiful sense of humility that you can gain when you recognize that the same mental stumbling blocks that you carry around and you deal with are the ones that Einstein dealt with, the ones that Plato dealt with, the same problems that every great leader and great thinker has ever had to worry about. We have, I write primarily about three different things in the book. There are biases, heuristics, and fallacies. And it's almost like the anatomy of our behavior. A bias is like, say you're right-handed. This is something Thomas Gilovich, the psychologist, this is the way he explained it, and I like the way he explained it. He said that if you're right-handed, then you have a bias toward your right hand. And in a situation where you could use either hand, you'll tend to use the right. And there are dozens, maybe hundreds of biases, most of them identified in the 60s, 70s, 80s by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for all this in the 2000s. And these are things like confirmation bias, where you tend to seek out information that confirms what you believe, but you tend to ignore information that challenges your preconceived notions. Or normalcy bias, which is whenever you are threatened by a giant, ambiguous threat, you tend to continue engaging in acts of normalcy so that you can feel as if nothing is wrong. There are many, many of them. I was only able to fit about 50 into the book. But and then there's also heuristics, and those are ways that – those are sort of when the brain trades accuracy for speed. It's sort of say you have a – somebody throws a garden hose in your lap, and you think it – looks kind of like a snake, and you go, oh, a snake, and you throw it out of your lap. Well, that's a good example of a heuristic. You didn't take the time to examine the situation. You just reacted as quickly as possible based off of a mental heuristic for snakes. But we have lots of mental heuristics for other types of things in our lives that under the best of situations treat us well, but in the worst of situations don't. For instance, you're far more likely to die in a car wreck on the way to get the lottery ticket than you are to win the lottery at all. But we don't really have a heuristic built in for dying in a horrible car wreck, but we do have a mental heuristic built in for what kind of status we would gain from winning the lottery. So stuff like that. The mental stumbling blocks that we have to deal with because the brain is not a vast, perfect supercomputer that we can depend on for even though we've done great, amazing things, and we continue to progress forward, we have sort of some built-in stumbling blocks we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Are there hidden persuaders out here? Are we really programmed more than we really – that's really what you're saying, in a way, is that we're programmed and predisposed and we have so many preconceived ideas that we're not really aware of. Is that sort of – what you're saying as you expand your thought, that thought throughout the book?
Yeah, I mean, that's what is one of the themes. Yeah, we are built to think in certain ways and not in others. And a lot of that stuff is evolutionarily based, things that served us well throughout our evolutionary history and that in the modern era maybe not serve us as well or get hijacked. And then there's also the brain is a very adept at pattern recognition, and we tend to err on the side of recognizing patterns instead when there are no patterns to be recognized. For instance, the Texas sharpshooter fallacy is the idea is a guy shoots the side of a barn over and over again that fills up with holes. Then he walks over to the side of the barn and paints a bullseye around where the holes clustered together, and therefore he is putting human meaning on top of random chaos. And we do that all the time. You know, we say deaths come in threes, or we say that when a tornado spares a neighborhood and goes off into the woods, we say, "Oh, that was miraculous." But when it actually does hit, you know, a town or whatever, we don't say that. We tend to notice the hits and ignore the misses. It's another big part of being a person is, you know, when we look at a cloud, we don't say that's an amorphous cluster of water molecules. We say that's a teddy bear, or we say, you know, that looks like a mountaintop or something. We are built to find patterns in the noise, and sometimes that can get us in trouble too.
Right. When you were formulating your ideas for this book, did you have to struggle with your own self, your own ego?
Oh man, yeah.
Just tell us about that. What kind of actions and struggles did it manifest in?
There's nothing in the book that I'm not guilty of, and I'm not really sure any of it can be completely deleted from you either. But it does help to know that you're prone to this kind of stuff. For me, the thing that was the most helpful to recognize and to understand was procrastination. Like everybody else, I'm a horrible procrastinator, but I'm in a profession and also now in writing this book and in the book that's to follow, I am dealing with procrastination. And I always thought that procrastination was just laziness. But when you actually look into the research, you see that procrastination is more of a failure to have a strategy to deal with your future self. It's in psychology, it's called present bias. And that's thinking that the way you see the world now and the things that you want now and the emotions that you, and desires you have now are going to be the same emotions, desires, thoughts, and feelings that you're going to have an hour from now, a day from now, a year from now, and so on. And even though logically that seems like, oh, okay, yeah, I don't think that, you do. And when you're put into the lab and when you're put into situations where you have a choice, we tend to fall back on intuitively believe that the way we feel now is the way we'll feel in the future. And that sets you up to do things like, okay, when I get off work, I'm going to work out for 2 hours, and then I'm going to write this paper, and then I'm going to do this, 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 this. And then you get off work, and you're no longer the same person that made those plans. You go, oh, I'm too tired. I don't want to do all that. I'll do that tomorrow. And you, in the lab, they show that they can ask people to, they give people a choice between something like a cupcake or a salad, and they tell them they have to pick it tomorrow. And when they go to give them that 24-hour period of time, when they do sit down to get it, they always go for the candy instead of the nutritious meal or whatever. We're very bad at predicting our future selves, and we're very bad at seeing ourselves as being in the flow of time, as a different person now as we'll be in the future. My favorite study in that was something where they had people, they gave them a bank of movies to pick from. Some of them were lowbrow, some of them were highbrow. There were things like Speed and The Mask and stuff like that, and Schindler's List and The Piano on the other end. And they said you, over the course of these 3 days, you have to watch three different movies. And people tended to pick the lowbrow stuff up front and the highbrow stuff at the back, always putting off the nutritious stuff till later.
Okay. Boy, that's interesting. We're going to take another break here, and we'll be back. Thank you very much, David McCraney, for being with us.
George is having a little bit of technical difficulties. We have a wonderful guest tonight. He wrote a book called You Are Not So Smart. His name is David McCraney, and his website is youarenotsosmart.com. And welcome back to the program, David.
Hey, thanks.
Now, we understand you've got another project in the works already.
Yeah, I'm sort of launching off of a couple of the things I wrote about in You Are Not So Smart. You Are Not So Smart is more sort of an overview of and an introduction to a lot of the topics that psychology has studied and concerning self-delusion. And I keep coming back. I talk about it in the book a good bit, and I talk about it in the blog since I finished the book, to this idea of why do we argue so much on the Internet? Why is it so easy to slip into an Internet argument over politics and religion and brands and morality? And just in general, I find that I'm always fascinated when people get into flame wars on the Internet and start really attacking each other and pulling out information from left and right all through Google and presenting their positions. We were talking in the break about how, in high school, people tend to spend a lot of time thinking about how to signal to each other what group they're part of. You know, we call them cliques in high school, but it also comes, even though people are very cliquish, they're also sort of very homogenized, where they they tend to buy the same clothes or you have the same smartphone or same laptop or watch the same shows. And there's this constant process of signaling to each other that I am the same as you in this way, or I am at least at the same status as you in this way, or a higher status. But also I am a member of this group and I'm not a member of that group. I'm a member of this group and I'm not a member of that group. And you can see that in if you just spend any time on Facebook, you notice that people tend to signal a great deal in their stream, saying they'll either send out a quote or they'll share a news story with you or they'll share a video or they'll just make a simple one-line statement about somebody in the news or about a political issue or whatever. And they're really trying to signal to the other people, hey, guess what? This is the group that I'm in. And they're almost you know asking for someone to challenge them so that they can signal whether or not that they're part of the group that they're in, and they can also defend themselves and to sort of solidify in their minds that they're right. That's what I'm researching now, and a couple of things that you can actually look at on the blog: the illusion of asymmetric insight and the backfire effect are two really weird ways that we go about this. The backfire effect being the one that I get the most email about, and that's a study where they actually had people proclaim their political viewpoint. In this study, they had like people who said that they were very liberal or they were very they identified themselves as a Democratic or Republican, as a liberal conservative, and they had them read fake news stories. The news stories were. And one in particular said that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and the other news story said there were not weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And then they would have the group read a reversal of the story that had the actual facts. So at first they would read a story that said there were no that there were weapons of mass destruction found as soon as we invaded Iraq. And then they would read a correction that said, actually, no, there were never any weapons of mass destruction found. And the weird thing they discovered were the people who were liberal and democratic, who the correction would serve their belief system, were like, yeah, no big deal. But the people who were on the other side of the political spectrum, when they read the correction, instead of feeling that the story had been corrected, they believed what they believed beforehand even more strongly. They doubled down on their beliefs. They said the correction just wasn't true, and they became more convinced there actually were weapons of mass destruction and there was some sort of cover-up at play.
Wow.
And that's called the backfire effect.
It's true. I mean, I see it. Yeah, these teenagers, the signaling, you said over the break, you know, this is where they're cutting their teeth. They're beginning to learn that they are in a group and they have to deal with the group dynamics and so what is different from being a teenager than say being a 20-something?
You know, there are no real stakes involved whenever you're, and I'm not an expert in this, but this is just from what I'm looking at, I would say that there aren't as many stakes involved once you don't have as much you don't have as much to lose when you're in high school. You're just simply trying to signal your status and what group you belong to and try to move up that status, just like any primate would, just like apes in the jungle would. You know, you are just like a chimpanzee or a bonobo would. You are deeply invested in understanding your level of status and the pecking order of the group that you work with. And when you move into the actual adult world where you have to pay for food and electricity and a car note and a house note or whatever, then it becomes very important that you learn how to cooperate and maybe tone down your rhetoric and get and integrate yourself into belief systems that you may not 100% believe in, but you learn to compromise so that you can get along, and that's how society works. But while you're doing that, you can slip over to your favorite website, you can slip over to your favorite social media watering hole and proclaim your true in-group status and get into a little argument and maybe feel better.
Hey, David, how about these games, these computer games? How do they affect our young people in these high schools?
There's a lot of weird research into games and how they affect people. I'm not an expert on that, but... from what I've read, you can games are they're not really negatively affecting people. And whenever you play up the anonymity, that could be something that affects people. But from what I see, there's no real downside to it unless games are replacing healthy socialization. And if they're an escape that goes beyond entertainment, it goes beyond what you would get out of a movie or what you would get out of going to see a play, or goes beyond watching a television show, if it goes to the point where you are adopting a new persona and you're absorbing yourself into that world to escape the social world that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, that's when it can become dangerous.
Well, I have a story. I have a 14-year-old who asked me to go to GameStop, purchase this $10 card so that they could do Roblox, and I didn't purchase the correct $10 card, but the teenager took it anyway, and I said, well, why didn't you tell me that I purchased the wrong one? And the teenager said, because I got to put on a new outfit and I look better now. I like the new outfit. I said, okay.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that game, but I don't know. But it is, you know, escapism.
But she doesn't know these people. But yet she got great satisfaction that she had upgraded her costume in this online community of people she really doesn't know in real life face to face.
Yeah, you know, some of the social gaming, like Farmville, for example, and games like that, that kind of lock you into a never-ending cycle of trying to tend to a life form that's going to die and you're going to lose your investment in the future. They play into, in any game structure, they play into our psychological biases straight up. The Farmville plays into something called the sunk cost fallacy, which is when the more you, if you put in a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of money into something, even though you can tell that that thing is going to eventually crash and burn and not be, and fail, you'll stay the course. You'll stay the course to try to justify the investment you put in so far. And it's something that we're prone to doing, and it's pretty predictable. A lot of those games that allow you to signal to your friends and family, hey, I just bought this new thing, or hey, I leveled up, or you're saying like that person got a new outfit. They play into the same old stuff where you're showing off status and you're trying to pull people into that alternate reality where you can be a little bit better than the person you are right now.
Interesting. And of course, teenagers are under extreme pressure for that.
Yeah, that's the playing ground.
They're learning it.
High school is all about learning how to signal.
Okay, we got to take another break there, David. Charlotte, we'll be right back. Thank you.
All right.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm Charles Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back to David McCraney, author of You Are Not So Smart. The website to check the book out is youarenotsosmart.com. Welcome back, David.
Hey,
I had a question about over the break or some point in this discussion. We were talking about the heated debates that erupt in blogs, in YouTube chat, you know, people responding to a video and such. And would you like to expand a little bit about your observations of what people do in the cyber realm that doesn't really happen in the person face-to-face realm?
Yeah, there are a number of things to play in. First of all, the first thing anybody will bring up will be anonymity. And that's something that there's a debate over amongst the tech crowd as to whether or not anonymity is a good thing. Some places like Google+, they're trying to push people to use their real names. Facebook, trying to get people to use their real names. But then you have sites like Reddit and 4chan. They ask people, they allow people to be completely anonymous, and there's just different ways of working your online persona. So anonymity, of course, is going to allow people to act in a way that they wouldn't act if they had to be accountable. And then you're also in a virtual space where, you know, your words are you. You are manifested in the way you use language. And the only way to deal with a person when you're very angry is going to be through vitriol and through ad hominem attacks and stuff. And there's no actual threat on your person, and so you're allowed to be as nasty as you want to be. So both anonymity and knowing that you're in a completely virtual space, they both play into some of the more exaggerated ways that we deal with each other. But there's also some other psychological biases and weird effects that play in. The illusion of asymmetric insight is one of those that's we tend to believe that we are complicated and deep and nuanced, and that our opponents are sort of easy to read, that they're simple, and you totally understand where they're coming from. You don't have to do much research into who they are. They're not nuanced, and you are nuanced, and that's the illusion of asymmetric insight. And we do that both for individuals and for groups. And we rarely give people, especially when we're arguing online, the opportunity to present to us the complexity of their viewpoint. We tend to very much water down their argument and believe that they're coming from a place that's far simpler than we're coming from.
Yeah, and there's also that character assassination. You know, people will quickly, rapidly descend into character assassination. It has nothing to do with the debate at hand. And like you, I've also observed people bringing out great resources of books and quotes and
right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was my thought.
There's an ad hominem attack still, even on the web, huh? Cyber war.
Oh, yeah, ad hominem, straw man fallacy. These things come out when we argue with each other, you know, and they're predictable. We know they're coming. We will tend to, if we get too wrapped up in the argument, we'll start attacking the person's character instead of what they have to say. And if we... If we are really reducing their argument to some sort of simple version that we can understand and we can destroy, you know, we'll start turning it into a straw man argument where we say, well, if you obviously you're the kind of person who believes this, this, and this, and that's something that's easy for us to argue about. When we get into heated debates online, it's really more of we're not really trying to win. We're not really trying to beat the other person. We're trying to convince ourselves that we're correct. We're trying to assert in our own hearts that we have that we're coming from the correct, proper, and well-researched position. And thanks to stuff like confirmation bias, you can if you get into an argument online with someone, you can get on Google and find information to back yourself up. And eventually, it just becomes two oceans colliding into each other of data. And the lesson you need to learn is you cannot win. You can't win an argument on the internet. It's not going to happen. You could be a Nobel Prize-winning scientist in climate research, and you could be debating a guy who is just you could just be debating your local councilman who has no scientific understanding of anything, and that person will argue just as vehemently as another scientist would, and you will never gain any ground. So it's important to remember that arguments on the internet, you will never win them. It's impossible. Even when you've won, you don't win.
Well, what about hating and stuff? Benjamin Franklin had things to say about that, didn't he? Do you hate the person and build a case on him, the one that you do dirty to? You build a bigger case of hatred or what? What's that about?
The Benjamin Franklin effect is the way I had a lot of people ask me to talk about cognitive dissonance, because even though I talk a lot about cognitive dissonance, I never have actually addressed it on the website. So to explore cognitive dissonance, I talked about the Benjamin Franklin effect, which is this, it comes from an anecdote about Benjamin Franklin where he had someone who was, who very much opposed him when he was running for office. And, this person was always making speeches about him and he hated him. And so Benjamin Franklin wanted to bring this guy over to his side. And so to do it, he just simply asked him for a favor. He asked him if he could borrow a book from this man's library. It was a very rare and difficult to find book. And this man obliged. He gave him the book. Benjamin Franklin kept it for a little while, returned it, and from that point forward, the man never said another nasty thing about him. So this comes out of Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, so we don't know whether or not it really happened, but we do know that the research shows that that's a real effect, and we tend to grow to like people that we do favors for, and we tend to grow to hate people that we harm. And it's something called cognitive dissonance, where we have we don't know exactly the source of our thoughts and emotions and behaviors, but whenever we feel icky about what we've done, whenever we feel like we've run counter to our own in-group's standards, or when we have run counter to our own morality, we will tend to reduce the dissonance that we feel by changing our attitude. So that guy was like, okay, I've just done a favor for someone I don't like, and that's not going to work for me. That feels icky. I guess I actually like the guy. Otherwise, why would I have done this? Okay, now I like this guy. And it's a weird thing that we do, but it's to reduce cognitive dissonance. That's one of the ways that we see the world. And if you want to spread love and positive energy into the world, you have to actually act, because attitudes tend to follow behavior more than behavior follows attitude.
Are there a certain number of people that, like on Facebook, that we can communicate with? Number 150, I think, is what you have in there. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's something called Dunbar's number, and that's comes from the anthropologist Robin Dunbar. Dunbar is a person who studies he studied primates, specifically the neocortex of primates and how they socially groom. So social grooming is when you see great apes, whenever they pick the bugs off each other's backs, they groom each other's fur. That's something they do to maintain group cohesion. And we do the same thing, a Super Bowl party or getting drinks after work or sharing pictures of our kids with each other. That's also social grooming. But that takes a lot of time and effort, and it takes a lot of mental capacity. And according to Robin Dunbar, we can only really maintain that social grooming, group cohesion relationship with about 150 people, give or take a few. And so knowing that's true, that means that's about the – if even if you have 3,000, 4,000 friends on Facebook – the people you deeply interact with are probably usually only about 20 people, but the maximum amount of people you'll be able to actually deeply interact with is about 150.
I noticed they have a selection on Facebook. It says acquaintances and close friends. Is that what they're trying to do, is start dividing that large group into little smaller groups which you're more friendly with?
Yeah, that's all based off of Dunbar's number and other research. Google introduced this idea with something called circles, the idea that you can have people who you are loosely contact with, people you have weak connections with and people you have strong connections with, and there can be overlap and everything. And Facebook is trying to integrate that into their system as well, although sort of less obviously and maybe a little bit more in a clunkier manner, but it is definitely something you'll see more of in the future, where we want to separate the people we go to work with the people that we went to high school with the people we actually can, you know, keep a secret with.
I thought it was fascinating what you just said about if you get somebody to do a favor for you that doesn't like you, that you can turn them, and because it creates a cognitive dissonance in them, and they will decide that they like you, because that's fascinating, David.
Yeah, it's attitude follows behavior, and that's one of the major principles of social psychology.
Something like, he's a lousy person, but he has a few saving graces, right?
Well, you know, you can't. The way you behave will greatly determine the way you think. More than the way you think will determine the way you behave.
Well, now let's get on the other side of the hour. Let's talk about observing our thoughts and how that could play a key role in waking up to the way that we really are. You think?
Sure.
That's hard.
I think that's the real problem, is that we don't observe our thinking close enough. We just think. We don't watch it and see from outside ourselves and look back at ourselves. We'll be right back. Top of the hour. Thank you.